6-year-old have. But he'll be talking for about 15 minutes, just giving you a little bit of a background on himself, and also just what he won the Nobel Prize for, and then we'll open up to you for a question and answer period. So I hope everyone has their questions prepared. But just in terms of background, Sir Anthony James Leggett is the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Chair and Centre for Advanced Study Professor of Physics at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's widely recognised as a world leader in the theory of low-temperature physics, and his pioneering work on superfluidity was recognised in the 19th by the 2003 Nobel Prize in Physics. He has shaped the theoretical understanding of normal and superfluid helium liquids and other strongly coupled superfluids. He has set the directions for research in quantum physics of macroscopic dissipative systems and the use of condensed systems to test the foundations of quantum mechanics. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Russian Academy of Sciences, and is a fellow of the Royal Society in the United Kingdom, the American Physical Society, and finally, the American Institute of Physics. He's an honorary fellow of the Institute of Physics in the United Kingdom, was knighted by the Queen Elizabeth II in 2005 for services to physics. He holds dual US-UK citizenship and is married with one daughter. His research areas are theoretical condensed matter physics, low-temperature phenomena, foundations of quantum physics, quantum fluids, statistical physics, macroscopic quantum systems, and tests of measurement of quantum theories. Without any further ado, Professor Anthony.
Really very nice if I would start this talk by telling you how my excellent experience of physics at high school actually led me to become a physicist. Well, that wouldn't be true because I had no experience of physics at high school. Except for one very small later. In fact, what happened was that I went to school in Britain in the late 40s, early 50s. And it so happened that because my father got a teaching job at a particular public school, public school, I was able to go there. This school was, I think, even by the standards of Britain in the late 40s, early 50s, a little fashion. And basically they took the view that if you had any kind of demonstrated academic talent, as my family did, if you didn't have very strong views to the contrary, then what you should do was go to the most prestigious stream which they had, which was physics, Latin, Greek, languages, and literature. So I did. I had to essentially make the choice which stream to go in, which for most people, I think, in Britain in those days, essentially determined very much of their careers. I had to make that choice at the age of 13, and I've got really good positions for another number. I think I should just mention that my father, I told my father was a teacher. He was actually a teacher of physics, chemistry, and mathematics, but he never presented me on the so I mentioned him in classics. Well, I continued with classics at Boston, and I got a scholarship to Balliol College, Boston, and I did what was the minor resistance. I decided to study for the Soviet Quakes, Quakes course, technically known as the Urez, is a, I think, peculiar to Boston. So, no, you basically spending your first five trimesters studying Latin and Greek languages and literature outside of school. Thereafter, you study in equal measure ancient history, ancient and Greek and Roman, and philosophy. Philosophy is what you want. I listened to this course, and I enjoyed it very much. Very much indeed. I was getting well academically and so forth in it and so forth. But it's a 4-year course, and towards the end of my third year, I gradually began to realise that I'm not going to be able to form a student ever. It's going to have someday have to do something to do with someone who's going to pay me. This is like 7th. I looked around to see what my contemporaries and the great schools were doing, and basically, a few exceptions, don't get one of these things. Either they were going to Christian civil service, or the great schools were a big source of people doing civil service, or they were becoming teachers, either at high school or university level, one of the subjects they studied in their great schools, classical languages, and history or philosophy. Well, I did briefly contemplate going into nursing service, but I concluded that in an unlikely event they would take me, it was going to be a major disaster for the country. So that led to teaching. And, well, of the three subjects, I don't know to all of them, but the one I enjoyed most of all, and in some sense, Spanish most at, was philosophy. Some of the, most of the piece, I don't think, will be still to know. Philosophy is not taught at high school. So if I were going on to become a teacher of philosophy, it could be at university. So I began to contemplate career in academic philosophy. And the more I thought about it, I gradually subconsciously realized that and so I started asking myself, exactly, why do I want to do this? Now, you can also have a more imaginative, I might ask myself the question, do I actually want to go on in academic life at all? But not being too imaginative, I said to myself, what's wrong with philosophy? And the answer I came up with, and I still remember formulating it very, very explicitly myself, is the answer I came up with was that. I didn't really want to go on doing philosophy as a career, because that's how what seemed to count as good or bad work in philosophy seemed to be so incredibly dependent on the precise nuances of words that you use, the precise way in which you phrase your arguments. And there seemed somehow to be no objective external criteria of whether what you're doing is good or bad work. And so kind of I put in my focus on what that kind of an external criterion for whether or not it was right or wrong or bad. And so I started thinking about all this. And firstly, I thought actually about was pure mathematics. Because actually, I had a very interesting, actually, in terms of my career, I was in a crucial experience in Catholic where a retired priest was a Jesuit school. So there were not only were many of the teachers, clerical, but there were a number of priests who were retired and were on premises. And one of these people had taken me over one day and given me a sort of crash course in modern mathematics or something, which in fact is incredibly valuable. But anyway, so I started thinking, well, at least I have a little experience in mathematics, what about that? It's a career. And then I remember rejecting this, and the reason I gave myself this one quite clearly was that mathematics. On the nature of the subject, if you're wrong, it means you're stupid. I'm going to ask you to be wrong without being stupid. In other words, I'd like to know non-trivial conjectures about the behaviour of the world and have nature that may travel about my life. And so I'm going to conclude that maybe this is that kind of subject. Now, it's not absolutely, not quite literally true that I had no physics at all in high school. I had actually one off-class scholarship, I had one semester's worth of my father's classes, as I said, computer physics, one of the things. But this was a very, very standard course, I guess, mechanics and thermodynamics training, taught to people who already had 4 or 5 years. It was literally about your money around the other. So it was not really particularly important to that element of my decision. Well, I had, I should say, in retrospect, I'm incredibly lucky to have made this switch. It was outrageous. I mean, it was almost unheard of in those days in the UK for anyone to do anything second undergraduate degree, let alone one which had no high school experience. So there were a number of factors which conspired to help me with this. And as I say, I think I've been incredibly fortunate to be able to make this switch, but I did. I did my undergraduate degree, postgraduate degree with Dr. Hall in Oxford. And eventually, after some peripatetic years, I actually went to the University of Oxford for a year, the postgrad. I went to Kyoto in Japan for a year, etc., etc. Eventually, in the fall of 1967, I settled down at the University of Sussex in the UK. a number of thesis in theoretical world temperature physics, in particular on nuclear which is a real isotope opinion, which has some very interesting problems of low temperature. So I continue to work in this sort of general area. But by the about the summer of 1972, I got very vulnerable working in traditional low-temperature physics. And I become more and more intrigued by questions in foundation chemistry, which is something I began to feel that maybe I should quit doing energy physics and develop a sort of constant foundation problem to try to tangle with some of these conceptual problems. Well, in the late, I think it was in early June of 1972, I was on holiday in Scotland, on the mountains, having a good time. And for some reason I had to call back to Paris, and and who was the phone called me at the school in London, or Richardson, from one of the universities in the US. With him I had some correspondence, in fact, we never met. But on Richardson, that was going to come through to Sussex on such and such a day, and would it possibly like to talk to him? Well, I obviously wanted to talk to him, but in fact, in order to talk with him, I was just going to cut short for that one on the day. I didn't quite return to talking about it, so I never always thought it was common. I think, in fact, it might, as it does, was on the morning question and make a decision. That fixed it for me, and I came back and thought more. I remember him something like every other afternoon, and once he'd gone, I just couldn't sleep. What he told me was so, seemed to be so extraordinary. One thing that's all important, because in retrospect, in some sense, one's dealing with a very special system under very special conditions, you'll see what's pretty brilliant, not an unspectacular effect. But for me, it was very, very exciting. Basically, at low temperatures, that is below about 100 millikelvin, down to roughly 3 millidegrees, which is roughly, so about 100,000 degree temperature, which is roughly as far as most people have gotten. It's actually really rather good. The atoms in 3 are so-called fermions, they're like fermion statistics, much like the electrons and metals. And there's a lot of work about the theory of how the atoms of helium 3 should behave in the liquid at low temperatures, which basically is that they can behave much like electrons in an ordinary single metal. But there have been some speculations that just as the electrons of normal metal form so-called Cooper pairs, they pair up and become sort of a giant molecule, and then this gives you superconductivity. We could speculate that maybe something similar would happen in helium 3 and would lose some of the fluid. It comes to being up into his long electric charge. But there have been a few papers written on this, and I didn't even try to think about it myself. But what I've been doing was nuclear magnetic resonance experiment. And in nuclear magnetic resonance, basically, you think of your spins as like little magnets, which are precessing around an external field. And in all the experiments that I've ever done so far, you can measure the precession frequency, and it basically is a measure of what's inside, which is a measure of the external magnetic field. Everything worked fine. The nuclei have got to have a definite precession frequency, you can work out the field which corresponds to that, and lo and behold, it's just the field that you make. So everything was looking fine, there were no problems. Then, when we went down to a temperature of about 2.5, which was just about as far as anyone had ever got, perhaps a bit further, it suddenly seemed to sound something weird again. The frequency of the precession was still very sharp, it was still very well defined, and partly shifted up away from the away from something wrong with that, the value which ought to correspond to it. And what's going on? Well, first sight, you said, well, it somehow is somehow mixed, you have to take into account. So if you find this thing about that, if you thought about that and you looked at the way in which the frequency of this position scaled with the field, external field of unit control, what you actually determined was if the field you had if the field you apply is in this direction, say, then this is for field had actually a field of the rear. Well, so far so good, that looks okay. You start asking what are the causes. You know the electrons are being thrown in a trailer in the very end of the gas. So the only thing that will happen that will cause that is an empty spin. But then you actually put in the numbers, and you find that even if you cram the first of your nuclei together within, say, a rainstorm, it is much closer. Still not enough to give rise to this transverse group. I really not seen this, and it seemed in fact that this was so extraordinary, this phenomenon so small, so difficult to reconcile with everything you about standard block mechanics or statistical mechanics, maybe something really fundamental is going on. Maybe under these extreme conditions, a very dense system very cold particles, very vast, or something of the kind, maybe quantum mechanics itself, or statistical mechanics or something, is breaking down. So I said to myself, well, maybe I'll go postpone my foray into the discussion of quantum mechanics and confront quantum mechanics to work. So the first thing I did after one goal night was to sit down and try to try to construct a specific proof that given the standard rules of quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics, this would have been simply not true. Well, my great surprise, I found it could. But it required something very, very strange. It required a hypothesis that whenever you've got a pair of nuclear spins coming together, at least they're similar to two magnets, they interact just as two combined magnets would. So they prefer to be end-to-end, if they're point this, they prefer to be end-to-end on the solar side. But the energy which distinguishes these two configurations is tiny. It's about 10 to the minus 7 degrees absolute, which remember is four orders of magnitude colder than the thermal energy distinguishes. Why doesn't the thermal energy disrupt this? Well, that was where I was, and I think I probably didn't see it for about 3 weeks. And finally, I figured out by the satisfaction that was going on. Basically, what happens is something more like what happens in an iron, say, a magnetic iron. In a ferromagnetic iron, there are forces which would like all the spins to lie parallel, but they don't tell you which direction the spins ought to lie. And it's the external magnetic field, if they don't realize the field, which tells you these spins in which direction they ought to lie. But the fact that they're all lying in the same direction, that's not due to the external magnetic field, that's due to these intrinsic or external fields. Similarly here, what I figured was that there was some other effect which forced all the pairs to behave in the same way, but did not itself tell them which one. Okay, so now either you have to have all your pairs doing that, or you have to have all your pairs doing that. And now you see the thermal energy, well, sorry, the energy which stabilizes one configuration over the other, is not of the single pair energy, which is time 10 to minus 7 degrees. But that multiplied by something like 23, huge compared to the thermal energy. So that's why the thermal energy can't disrupt your core. That was nice, and I actually worked this out in some detail, and the general idea did seem to give very good, at least all the magnitude agreements. So I sent my fellow letters. One of my colleagues presented at the International Temperature Conference, which is just coming up, and of course, some attention. But the arguments I gave for this were very, if you like, general, hot, and so forth. and are not based on detailed Microsoft model. And my colleagues kept on telling me, you know, no one's really ever believed until you've got a detailed Microsoft model. And well, the next few months actually, I had all my time taken up teaching them to pass size experiment in the spring of 73. I was invited by the Registry of Health and Health for a month, and basically I was just in the VX with a thing about this. And during that month, I did, in fact, it was very, very exciting, I should say. I think that month was probably the most exciting of all my career years in physics. I was really right next to the experimental labs, talked to you every day, trying to figure out what was going on. And finally, I did figure out something. It was not only a microscopic theory of what was going on in three of those conditions. And it turned out that everything was at least consistent with the idea which other people had had, where they formed, namely that indeed in three atoms were two critters, two molecules, if you like, and thereby becoming superfluid. But what had not been clear, and what I think I was able to elucidate, was why this gave rise to these incredibly unexpected nuclear and resonance problems. So I was able not only to explain the existing data, but more excitingly, I was able to make some predictions for the behavior in experiments of a type which no one thought could conduct. But once they were suggested, people did go and conduct them, and sure enough, the predictions did come out. And so I think it's probably fair to say that the sort of general ideas of this kind of theory and the conclusions one could draw for the nature of the now it's in the face of him, so he had stood the test of time and textbook discussions of the subject. So that's basically a bit of work which the Nobel Committee eventually recognised. And again, I have to say, I just feel incredibly lucky at having been able to make this very, very unusual and unconventional transition from classics into physics. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been very informative, very interesting. So I'm sure most people have questions. So what we'll do now is we'll open up a couple of questions, and we have about 40 minutes, 45 minutes of questions. And so would anyone like to start off? Yes.
You mentioned 2.5 millikelvins as the bottom in your research.
Yeah.
As low as we could go. How low are they going today?
Well, that's an interesting question. Really depends on how you define temperature, but secondly, how restricted the system you're prepared to talk. If you, for example, consider the nuclear spins in a certain kind of insulating solid, like calcium fluoride, then there are techniques of cooling those nuclei, right? So they do in fact have, if you really describe our temperature, and it's way down to something like 10 to minus 10 degrees, that sort of thing. However, you have to bear in mind that you're talking about just the nuclear spin degree, which is not in anything like thermal equilibrium with other freedom, like, say, vibration resistance, and so on. Now, if you ask, okay, what about bulk matter? Again, it depends how you define bulk, but for example, if I use alkali gas, because nowadays can be cooled down to temperatures of the order of a few tens of 9 degrees, 10 minus 9 degrees. If you ask about, those are very, very low gases indeed. I mean, much more low than the air in this room. If you ask about really terrestrial density, as it were, liquid or solid matter, then I couldn't necessarily give you the very latest figure, but my guess would be somewhere about 10 microdegrees is the limit for, and usually for rather special systems, which have special properties which are meant to be included by the research. Routinely, I think if you ask, just give me some arbitrary bit of, say, solid, say, material of this strange whatever, how low could I routinely pull that? I would say the answer would probably be, if you're lucky, a few millimeters. So about the kind of temperatures that Bell was talking about. If you want to make extraordinary efforts, you can usually get them down there, but routinely, I'd say.
This is just kind of a broad question. There is a little sort of speculative thought that everyone coming through the same sort of channels of education and being self-selected in that fashion, that there actually limits to some degree the ability to think outside the envelope. Your unusual background, do you think that is actually advantageous to you? And have you seen that in your career?
I think it was. In the sense that one of the things that you learn, of course, when you do a standard degree in art and philosophy, is to try to take everything for granted. And in particular, I think as a philosopher, and particularly at some colleagues in Oxford and Sussex, a number of my colleagues, in fact, particularly at Sussex, were people who started life as physicists and got switched into philosophy. And they were very, very conscious of the sort of things that all their colleagues, their former colleagues in physics, took for granted, and were always continually annoyed by themselves. And I think that, for example, I suspect it would not have occurred to me that maybe something really fundamental was going wrong with the foundations of quantum mechanics had I not had this sort of general skepticism in philosophy as a background. I think many others like that might have trained in philosophy was very, very useful for me too. The other subjects were too, but not so directly.
How have your views in philosophy evolved as a result of the progress that you've made in science?
I suppose that I have tended to become a bit more like the traditional physicist in the sense that I try to, when someone poses a very general question, kind of philosophers tend to do, my first instinct is always to ask, does this have, as it were, any empirical content? Is it the kind of question which I can, in principle, do some experiments about? Now, if the answer is yes, well, fine, then I'll rush up to my experimental colleagues and encourage them to try. If the answer is more frequently is no, then I'm still interested, but in some sense I don't have quite the motivation that many professional philosophers do. Some particular examples would be, I don't know, some of you might make it familiar with this, it's probably not, but there's of course a lot of argument about the correct interpretation of the performance in quantum mechanics. And I think it's very important to be clear that there are very people argue about the performance of quantum mechanics or its interpretation. They may be arguing on one of two completely different levels. On one level, they may be asking, is quantum mechanics really the truth about the world? Is there other certain kinds of correction coming in, say, very short length scales or or the world or whatever, and if the answer to that question is yes, then you're basically envisaging a theory which is different from quantum mechanics, and you can in principle go off and test that hypothesis experimentally. On the other hand, there are a lot of arguments where people take the performance of quantum mechanics for granted, and take for granted the fact that it's always going to describe it as long as we care for looking, and then the question is, what does it mean? And these are arguments then about the interpretation of long-term theories. And a very typical example of that would be the so-called other way of interpretation, which originally, that was an alternative theory. Many predictions which alternative to quantum mechanics, but in its modern version, at least as it's found by most people, it really isn't an alternative theory. It's just another way of interpreting the standard theory. And I find it very difficult to get as strongly motivated that kind of thing as some of my colleagues in philosophy think of.
So just a little bit of clarification, and then maybe I can understand what you'd be asking. when you cool down the hydrogen, the nucleus, I imagine they kind of, they're getting closer and closer, and they start to go around each other.
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't sure about the, I first thought that, okay, if they're going like this, they generate an addition to that field, so therefore you see the difference. This way, also, I say bearing relation, I wasn't sure about anything in between there and there.
Yeah.
But what exactly is going on with those nucleuses such that they're making fields or making fields created?
Oh, yeah. It's actually, at least in this context, you can really think of these nuclear streams as just like tiny ball magnets. I mean, they're essentially just the same one. So if I take two ball magnets, both of which have their little cold starting buttons, then as you know, they'll tend to want to sit like that and often like that. If I try to push them like this, they'll resist it, because that force is quite considerable for the ball magnet. With helium-3 nuclei, it's exactly the same, but it's just the force is many orders of magnitude smaller. But basically, the effect is just good old electromagnetism.
Yeah, I was wondering at those millikelvin temperatures that you work at, because velocity is directly related to temperature, and you're talking about isolated atoms and dilute gas, because those low temperatures imply a low velocity. Shouldn't we be getting to the sort of level that the atoms would spread out?
Oh, well, yes and no. I mean, in fact, the statement that energy square root will not be the square root of this is proportional to temperature. That's basically classical. It's about classical. In quantum mechanics, that's not necessarily true. And in fact, in a so-called degenerate Fermi system like helium-3, we believe that the velocity of the atom, despite the fact that it's very, very low temperature, and the velocity of the atom is sort of flattening out to a quite low at non-zero depth. But you're absolutely right. Other kinds of systems one can look at, for example, one can look at the so-called dilute loads of other gases. And that is a fact. So some crude sense, the classical argument does. But as you go to lower temperatures, the velocities of the atoms go down and down. And in fact, it's one of the music facts I like to quote my good lecturer, Sir John Dick, yes, is you have these atoms, and you know, you have a good atom, in the street, they'll probably think these little things rushing around with enormous velocities. The actual speeds of the atoms in a most condensed alkaline gas at low temperature period, now the Virginia Tang will lag, the actual speed is slower than that of an arthritic snake. So things are very, very slow, and you're actually right, because of the uncertainty principle, this then means that they have to spread out in space. And indeed, that effect has been verified experimentally. They are.
So would they interfere, like an atom?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, these very spectacular experiments done. Again, mostly with these bodies getting started involved in helium-3. But the basic principle would be helium-3, but you have to do it with cubic pair for various reasons. That's something more concentrated. But yes, yes, indeed, actually. Yes. In fact, one of the most recent, over the last few years, with these very cold, I guess, is to try to reproduce as many as possible of the phenomena which are known to occur so late with natural life. I mean, we're not parallel.
We've just been looking at entangled photons.
Yes,
and superconductivity and superfluidity depend on the Cooper pairs. Perhaps could you clarify, both two very important quantum mechanical things, can you help us distinguish between them?
Yeah, okay. The first of all, if I'm dealing with a certain other system like helium-4, which I have some similarities there's really no question of entanglement there. It's rather that all the individual atoms occupy the same state. So in some sense, they're maximally distant, and since they're all doing exactly the same thing at the same time. Now, when you have a group of pairs in a superconductor, then indeed they are entangled. If you look at their spin structure, for example, then you have which notation you've been using, but I usually use this. You have a state in which electron 1 is up and electron 2 is down, minus a state in which one's down to his arm, and if you're having a few reasons for attention or not, well, that's a good result in taking the soap. And so, so yes, a pair within each pair. But again, the crucial point for superconductivity is not, the crucial point for superconductivity is that all these pairs, which you can think of crudely as like diatomic molecules, are more or less those convex, that is, they are all forced to occupy exactly the same state, do exactly the same thing at the same time. So they're like a very nice cartoon, which appeared on the cover of Science in the year when those are like gases were first realized, but it didn't really apply to superconductivity. Very nice cartoon showing the atoms of the most common side as like identical solvent or Martin Rothstein. As we look at
the nucleus that you experimented with there, again, what was it constituted of?
Well, it's the hitting through nucleus, so it contains two protons and one neutron.
What's a superfluid?
A superfluid? Very good question. that one which most of the regular textbooks, I don't think, discuss very well. Crudely speaking, a superfluid is a liquid which will flow through, for example, very narrow pores without current friction.
Okay.
But in fact, if you think about it from a fundamental point of view, superfluid is really not a single phenomenon, but a more complex phenomenon, which generally speaking tend to go to jet, but don't always go to jet. Now, one of these phenomena, which is something that I think is theoretically the most fundamental, is this. Take this picture of water. I put it on an old-fashioned graphite turntable, and I set the turntable into rotation on the stop. Well, initially, the water will go stationary, but after a bit, it'll start rotating. You can decorate it separately with some piles of dust or something. So you can see that the liquid is rotating for instance.
Right.
Debugging that with liquidium 4, which is the one which goes superfluid at the usual temperature, did this with liquidium 4 in exactly the same experiment, but doing it at reasonably high temperatures, much the same as the water we take with the container. And now it's coming, so I continue to rotate, but I cool down to much higher temperatures, to the impactless temperature where the liquid becomes superfluid.
Okay.
Then what happens? It's something that really quite extraordinary. The liquid gradually comes out of equilibrium with rotating container. And to all intents and purposes, it comes to a rest. As I go further and further down, it comes to a rest of the laboratory frame. Actually, we believe it doesn't. We believe that if we did this experiment in the North Pole, it would rotate once a day. In other words, it would come to rest in the frame if it starts on the laboratory. That's a different experiment. but anyway, this is in some sense, from a conceptual point of view, this is the most fundamental phenomenon of superfluidity because, you see, you can't explain this just by managing this system. If I were to do it the other way around, that is, if I were to put the liquid in the glass on a stationary turntable and then start cranking out the turntable, and if the liquid then failed to return, then I could say, well, that's because there's not enough viscosity, it has not enough contact in the world. But if I do it this way, that is, I first rotate and then cool. There's a film of empty people stuff. That's what makes it funny.
You mentioned the Bose-Einstein condensate, right. And the statistics that came out in 24-26 when Einstein was working with Bose. How relevant and how insightful was Einstein's contribution then? I guess intuitive then, to the level that Einstein was intuitive in other areas?
I think the answer is that it was extremely important. What happened was that Bose, who was at that time working in what is now Bangladesh, in the University of Dhaka, worked out a theorem which he regarded photons, the quanta of the electromagnetic field, as polarities. And he then showed that if you made a certain assumption about the statistics which these particles make, and particularly you made the assumption that states which differed only by the interchange of any two photons were the same stone, and if it's knocked out twice, you made that assumption that you've got time distribution. Now, what Einstein did was to go a little further and point out that this is good. You say if you had your particles and material properties, and you make a huge difference. In the case of photons, photons can be freely created or destroyed. So there's no conservation in terms of the number of photons. But with the atoms, that can't happen. That's the real difference. And then when Einstein derived the appropriate statistical distribution, he found that below a certain temperature, it started to be nonsense. And then he came out with the now, I think that many of Einstein's contemporaries probably didn't like that conclusion very much. They said, tended to say things like, well, okay, you just done this calculation for a totally non-interacting guess. Surely, I should take into account realistic iterations, this whole thing affects Einstein. What's amusing is, in fact, not the opposite. It turns out for most cases where you have a repulsive interaction, which for various reasons you usually do in alkaline gas, it actually strengthens the tendency to both Einstein compensation. So the Einstein argument is, you asked if it was intuitive, and it is. I mean, in the sense that once you've got the basic concept that interchanging any two atoms does not give you a different state, and therefore you should count them separately, then it's a sort of very, very straightforward one factor derivation result. But it was not at all obvious then, and in fact, it was not at all obvious until relatively recently, I would say. It's still going to work for an interacting system. It's our good idea.
Yeah, just with your philosophy background, we have all these various interpretations of quantum mechanics. Is there any sort of one that you align yourself with? When we talk, like the many worlds, Copenhagen.
I think my point of view would be that we're faced in the. If I were giving a different talk, I would be now talking about this, but. We do have the very fundamental power trade-off proposition. And it seems to me, in other words, crudely speaking, because Scott is very, very, very brief, I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, crudely speaking, if I've got, say, an atom or an electron which has two possibilities open to it, so they go down one or two paths, most interpretations of the form of the quantum mechanics say it doesn't do one or the other, somehow they just do both and neither. How do you know? You know because of the phenomenon of interference or an MC experiment. Quantum mechanics is a seamless whole, so, or potentially anyway. So if we now push it, its application further and further in the direction of the everyday world, we can't suddenly change that interpretation overnight. So we get to the Schrodinger's cat experiment, and this poor cat, and start a closed box. And pretty speaking, this poor cat is then neither in a state of neither being dead nor being alive until I actually take it off the box and inspect it. Whereupon I'll respond to the bill. That's the basic problem. Now, it seems to me that there are two possible reactions. One is simply to say, this paradox is enough to give us serious motivation to consider the possibility that quantum mechanics is not the whole truth. At some stage, between the atom and our own experience, something else comes in. We don't know what, we don't know where to play now, but something else comes in. And that's precisely the hypothesis I've been trying to encourage you to test experimentally over the last 35 years. Let's suppose that doesn't work. It hasn't worked so far, I should say. Every time that people are testing quantum mechanics in the direction of the natural world, they found it seems to work fine. No evidence at all right now on this particular axis. And let's suppose that someone comes back from the year 3000. What's our reaction then? I think, my reaction is the only sensible interpretation is what I call the extreme statistical interpretation. It had to go down various names in the literature. And which basically says, look, forget it. But it's stop trying to interpret mechanism, because it's just a recipe. Just a cookbook recipe whose only function is to give you ways of calculating the probability of directly observed macroscopic outcomes. So for example, in the Schrodinger's cat case, all the quantum mechanical formulas were ever designed for was to answer the question, if I take the lid off this particular box, this particular category, what's the probability I'll see the lid? What's the probability I'll see the lock? And similarly, if I'll make a call directly to the lid. I have to say, incidentally, that many of my, particularly my younger colleagues in the field of quantum information, seem to regard this point of view as entirely natural and then more as And I have to say that it contains no, as far as I know, it contains no internal contradictions. You can't generate either a logical or experimental contradiction out of it. It's very, very weird. Really say, in some sense, there's nothing out there. You've got this huge formula which our forefathers spent hundreds of years to develop. It doesn't correspond to anything out there in the real world, for many circumstances. So it's really very good. And I would like to be the example.
I have a question more about teaching, in particular, teaching young people at the high school level.
Yeah.
I was wondering, are there any sort of points or lessons or aspects of physics that really stand out in your mind that you would say, look, I think that all young people, if they study physics at high school, really should, you know, be taught this, whether it's something about the spirit of physics or it's the back one physics or whatever. Are there any, you know, get 3 points or whatever?
I think it is very important that people should realise that although it may be actually quite difficult, I'm not sure many people will, to always bring this out at high school level. Nevertheless, physics is a lot of experimental subject, and none of the laws of physics are so sacrosanct that they may not in future be overthrown by some experiment. Now, of course, no one says that. One has to obviously qualify to remark that obviously one would not expect the law of gravitation to break down one morning when something is happening. I think the general principles of induction, which we all use in our everyday work, one could question them because philosophers were sort of provisions in mind, of course it was not. fair enough, but none of us seriously organises his or her life on the assumption that we're going to take it down. So at least I think it's very strong, reasons to hope that. For example, the laws of classical physics will still continue to apply approximately in the kind of area where we find them in the past. So in other words, we're not particularly likely to wake up one morning and find that there's some phenomenon going on at an everyday level of this cup, for example, which is not going to be described by classical physics. That seems unlikely. On the other hand, most people, most practicing physicists these days, regard quantum mechanics, at least, as a complete structuring principle of the universe. And that is not only obvious. It's not obvious that when we go to towards the macroscopic world, you won't find something peculiar. Say, like we're trying to kind of chase for the last 25 years, it's not obvious. If we go down to the submicroscopic scale, the so-called planck scale, again, things are not going to change qualitatively. It's not even obvious that familiar things like the laws of statistical physics and so forth would be valid under totally arbitrary conditions. So I think we should always remember that. No law of physics is so subject to the fair. And now the more specific thing is that I actually would be very much in favour, and I suspect perhaps there are people who are in the room. I would be very much in favour of teaching at least the elements of quantum mechanics at high school, not even grade school. When I say the elements of quantum mechanics, I don't mean sure. simple examples of mechanics and the word results of this as well. And basically, two reasons for that. First of all, I think it is exciting and it will. It make people realise some very weird and bizarre things going on with quantum physics, and perhaps they attract more people who might want to go into physics. And one second, my second motivation was, I guess that sometimes it, there are ways of putting this across which make it clear that the fundamental quantum mechanics make them dissolve. They're not particularly hot. They don't involve a huge amount of algebra or integration or anything like that. In the past, I think traditional education in, say, the university level in physics, basically started teaching quantum mechanics, things like Schrodinger's equations and so on and so forth, notions of operators, blah, 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 blah. The problem with that is that a lot of people tend to get the impression that the essence of quantum mechanics is somehow associated with these rather high powered mathematical methods. Really, it isn't. I mean, it's a lot simpler than that, even though it's much more bizarre. So I would be, I guess, not the strongest player of teaching at least the elements at some other level.
I'm a related question to that is, in the high school level, students are often very motivated by marks and get the marks for...
You mean M-A-R-K-S,
in order to get into university and whatnot. So that's a dilemma that teachers always face, teaching material where kids really want the marks.
Yeah.
And often students are a little bit intimidated with physics because they perceive physics as the honor subject of the science.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you have any opinions on that. If you had opinions on how things could be changed, what might your opinions be if you have opinions on this area?
Well, to be quite honest, I mean, I've had no practical experience of high school teaching, but I think I'm probably not the person to really comment on this, but I do feel that there are perhaps some rather fundamental and rather general ideas which one can at least try to fix. I've mentioned one, the idea of entanglement or qubits and entanglement in quantum mechanics, but yeah. See, the principle equivalence in general relativity, again, is something which you don't really cite very, very simple. Now, sure, I mean, to get any more anything beyond the most very simple applications, which you not a lot of more direct geometry and so on and so forth, but you can still get, I think, quite a bit of an interesting mind out of these very simple ideas. So I would be in favour of teaching them, even if you had to stop, say, well, you know, in order to really go further along these lines, you're going to have to take 2 years' worth of differential geometry. And in some sense, make it clear that the really basic and fundamental ideas are not complicated or difficult. In some sense, they're often simpler than ones that we can't. I think of procurement, for instance. You had this incredibly elaborate Ptolemaic system with examples and episodes and so forth. And the theory of the theory was placed as a complete theory. Maybe counterintuitive, but I think just about everyone that now has been creating what seems to produce them, what we're looking for. And I suspect when you know, make an expert if it comes in physics, it'll probably be the same. It'll be some fundamental idea which seems very bizarre at first sight, but which nevertheless does in some sense clear away all the trouble which is associated with some of these people.
There seems to be a lot in terms of quantum engineering and nanotechnology, sort of bringing these worlds together. There's some indication now we're finding sort of new laws of conductivity, et cetera, that were not observable at the aggregate level and that seem to be operating very differently at the nano level. Do we seem to be on any kind of a cusp of a whole lot of new knowledge coming forward?
Well, I think I would generalize with slightly different. I mean, I think there are lots of things which quantum mechanics predicts in principle about behavior of matter, say, at the nanoscale. That was the crudely speaking intermediate between the atomic level and the reasonably maxwell level. And I think we've always had it in our minds that there are these predictions out. But as you say, it's been it's not been easy to test, and it certainly has been some very exciting demonstrations of in some sense things we knew ought to be there, but haven't seen. But I don't think there's so far, by all means, in the field of nanoscience and nanotechnology, we've had any major surprises. We may have surprises in the sense that we can do things which we thought we could, but I suppose we can't do things we thought we could. But I don't think we've had any major surprises with regard to basic concepts.
In the work that you've done in physics, have you been influenced by people in other disciplines like physics or mathematics that illustrate or that we can use to illustrate the cross-connectedness of different course subjects?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Well, as I say, I would never have done what I have. It's completely chance serendipitous experience with this retired teacher of mathematics at my hospital. And in fact, when I came to make the switch into physics for classics, the first thing that people had to make a decision were basically the tutors at my tutors in physics at my college firm, David Brick, tutor for at the time. And his first thought was, did I have the mathematical background code? And in fact, what he did was first company, and we were coming up to the convocation before the last year. He sent me away on vacation to read a few chapters out of the book by Gordon Robin. It was a beautiful book. It's basically it's sort of introduction to some of the major areas of modern mathematics without seeing anything. Well, for some instance, he sent me this, and then he gave me a little test. But I think I probably not have been able to cope with it. I probably couldn't have even had the courage to even try it had I not had this my math teacher. Again, as I mentioned already, the later philosophy was a great help in the sense that. Not so much that it taught me specifically, but really philosophy doesn't teach you specific things. It gave me a sort of attitude of questioning what's taken for granted by the modern professional physics community.
Those nuclei that you're using and maybe your predictions necessarily an odd number of constituents?
Yes, actually. We believe that, I don't know if part is coming, actually, they don't. We believe that the elementary particles which make up matter, that is, electrons, neutrons, protons, they all are sort of fermions, that's fermion half in basic units, and they obey fermion statistics, which means that I can't put more than one of them into a random state. So they're highly zonotropic, only one part of the state makes them. However, if I make a complex set of molecule out of an even piece of objects, then it behaves like which exists in principle, but we don't think they end up in their constituents like that. These are, for example, the particles that have no spinning movement at all. In some sense, what's happening in helium 3 is you're getting pairs of these fermions forming a boson and undergoing some kind of close condensation. So you ask, well, okay, doesn't that mean that you've been better off dealing with bosons from the start? Well, the answer is not necessarily, because the actual dynamics of formation of the papers and sort of molecules. Depends strongly on the fact that they can't be one state at a time. So that's a detailed, very detailed technical matter, but in fact it is. So they do behave like fermions. But three neutrons, two electrons, five fermions, they do behave like fermions.
Do you believe that the fact that philosophy is not taught as a mandatory course in secondary school impairs in certain way the real understanding of quantum physics at secondary level?
Could be, actually. I certainly don't think it's really important to teach philosophy as a high school subject. And indeed, it might give people a new perspective. Perhaps trigger them. Perhaps induce them to be slightly less accepting of the standard ways of looking at them.
Might actually take two more questions. We'll finish with that. So are there any more questions? Yep, maybe Roberta and Peter.
One thing we're always searching for is how to make our subjects more concrete, more visual, more hands-on. Okay, the hands-on, well, that gets a little rough.
Yeah.
But it seems to me the one example in quantum physics that is really visual is the superfluid creeping up and along the beaker. I mean, that just is so, and it's macroscopic. You can see it. Can you just give us a little explanation what's going on there?
Okay. Yes, a lot of little bits. A rather special case, a much more general phenomenon involving superfluid, which is that they basically, once you've got them in motion, then they can essentially flow forever, despite the fact there are lots of obstacles in their way. A similar phenomenon is superconductivity and rip. If I start the car and go, you can fail. So the question is, what's the simple way of looking at that? Well, here's the way that I first find that are quite helpful. In both cases, the case of repairing, say, which is both convinced, and the case of superconductors, where the two repairs are essentially both convinced, you've got this very large number of objects, either single atoms or pairs of electrons, which are forced to behave in fact cells. They're not able to do so. Now, imagine two experiments in everyday life. You have a false tree, non-plantation, so it's not very irregular. The trees just dotted around, right? You sink into this forest a group of schoolchildren. And they're told that initially they have to run a certain direction, but then after that they need no special instructions. So what's going to happen? Some child is going to find himself running into the truth. You saw it for the world. Since you have no special instruction, you just go on in that direction. So after a few minutes, you'll find these kids are basically running on that lane. This is the analog of what happened in Norway. When I, say, fire a voltage pulse, thereby giving the electrons a kick, and then leave them themselves until the pulse. So if the electrons are now left in surface and no external thing, then we'll go back to the random process by scattering against impurities. Now imagine that you've done the same experiment, but you've done it with low voltage solids. And the solids have the instruction that they should try as far as possible to keep in step. But if one of them, for one reason or another, has to step out of the line, then as soon as possible, he needs to get back into the line and bolt along with his skulls. Incidentally, this is not a totally unrealistic experiment. I've actually, not long ago in class, I've been on a mountain rescue policy. I'm very, very much surviving. That's exactly how it works. You basically have a tunnel. All of you hold up, a dozen of you hold up to the stretcher. If one of you gets knocked off, don't worry, just come back over here and so forth. And that way the stretcher keeps on going to come downhill smoothly. And so it's a very analog of that is that your cubic pairs in the superconductor are all constrained to behave in exactly the same way. So even if one pair, one electron pair, gets scattered by the same impurity, they'll drop back into line and get very, very, very good. And that sounds sort of very naive explanation, but in some sense it does contain the essence of what we're going on.
Peter. I just got a question just with your work on superconductors. We've always sort of gone up in jumps in our temperatures. That jumps in superconducting temperatures.
Oh, superconducting temperatures,
yeah. Yeah, and there's, apart from our initial explosion of papers, it seems to have sort of plateaued at publication rates, and we haven't been able to get past that liquid nitrogen temperature. And what I think we're going to just run about the research in that area.
Okay, so let me just draw this, what you said. So we plot the transition temperature, that is the highest temperature at which any material is going to be superconducting. We plot it as a bunch of time starting in 1911 here, and at that time it was about 4 degrees, and then the summer around 1906 it was about 25 degrees, I guess. And then remember, loops and the continuum up. One up here, and now, as you say, actually it's kind of off at, well, by the time you get to these really high temperatures, superconductors, the actual ignition tends to tend to occur at a bit of time late, but pretty soon, about half the temperature. And so there obviously raises the question, is this some kind of hot limit? We expect it to go higher. Most of my colleagues in the high temperature super, their own colleagues in the high temperature supercomputer business seem remarkably sort of casual about this question. They seem to be, okay, well, probably it won't go much above 150 or 160. We don't know why it's still gone there, mind you, but I think most of them probably sort of shrug their shoulders and say, well, we're going to be going to go a lot higher. I think I'm different. I rather firmly believe that, that sometime in the next half century, at least, we are going to get very substantially higher transition temperatures, probably even with a 6.2 room temperature. Now, if I knew where to look for that, because if we were restricted to the materials which we can as we just take off the shelf in some sense, the materials which nature gives us without any very great product, then we would never have probably got much above 20 degrees. It's only because people started making, for various reasons in the day, they started making these rather unlikely compounds, which contain at least four different elements, that we ever have been affected, which is about degrees. Now, if you think of the literally trillions of possible compounds out, which have 5, 6, 7 elements in it, you realize we're really just beginning to explore the tip of the iceberg. I believe there had to be other materials out, which are going to have higher transition temperatures than the gift, as I say, will probably be robust superconductors at room temperature. But until we have, at the very minimum, not where we're going to need a good theory of acuteness, I think, to know which direction to look at, and probably need a lot more. I personally think it's a major challenge for the whole theory. As I say, I'm thinking of something using the equipment to do some more courses.
Okay. Thank you very much.